party, but surely somebody got it. She would march down that center aisle looking as implacable as destiny. Stopping at the appropriate table, she would demand, "Who threw that biscuit?" If the guilty party spoke up, she had just one word for him, "Out." But if no one spoke up, she would look the table over judicially for a moment and then say, "I think it came from this table." Then a pause. "Yes, I think it came from this table. Bondi, clear the table." So Bondi, who had been right behind her with his great aluminum tray, would pick up all the food, all the plates, and all the utensil, and that was that. No argument, no due process. But we lived in a dining hall that was always orderly. The food was always well prepared. If it was a little monotonous, we complained. Students always complained about institutional food. You didn't have to eat it if you didn't like it. You just paid for it. Breakfast I've already described. It was practically invariable. The midday dinner I remember hardly at all, except that we always had chili beans or hot chili con carne on Wednesdays. I never did like chili, and I still don't care for it. Supper was generally Swiss steak with grits and gravy and, you guessed it, skibs and zip, washed down with lots of strong black coffee. I don't remember any desserts. I don't believe we had any. Coffee at supper was good. Coffee at breakfast was a little bitter. They just added some extra coffee grounds and some water to the big coffee maker. Coffee at midday dinner was a repeat of the same and best avoided. And then in the afternoon they'd clean out the coffee maker and start over again, and supper's coffee would be good again. You must realize they didn't have good coffee makers like they have now that turn out a good cup of coffee in an institution every time. This was a fair apparently that they turned steam into. Anyhow, the coffee for supper was good, and the coffee for midday dinners wasn't drinkable. The table seated about 16 or 18 people, if I remember correctly, so you got together with 16 or 18 of your friends and went to Mrs. Gideon and asked for a table so you could eat together. At that point, you had a choice. You could pick the location of your table and take the waiter assigned to you by Ms. Gideon. Or you could pick your waiter and, did I say that backwards? You could pick your table and take the waiter she assigned you, or you could pick your waiter and take the location of the table she assigned you. We always chose our waiter. And for years on end, my table was served by a very first-class man with a good old Oxford name of Bim Isom. At supper time, Bim was always absolutely the last one to come back out of the kitchen with the sad news. There ain't no more skids back there, gentlemen. We paid $20 or $21 a month for our meals, and any necessary adjustment was made on the last month of school, for the spring semester. I think Ms. Gideon used to watch her budget carefully so that in May she'd have a little surplus and could treat us to strawberry shortcake for dessert when strawberries came in and were cheap. That way we always went home remembering those good meals with those delicious strawberry shortcakes for dessert. Registration was fairly simple. There were only about 650 students on the campus that year, so there were no long lines. The catalog was quite explicit. For BS men registering for the For freshman men registering for the BS degree whose names begin with the letters L to Q inclusive will register for English A at 9, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. History A at 11, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Mathematics A at 10, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and so on. 5.5 days per week. But there were no classes in the afternoon. There's no juggling of your schedule, no trying to avoid early classes or trying to pick an easy teacher. If your card was made out exactly like the catalog said, Dr. Hume would sign it, and if it was not, he would not. Entering the Lyceum from the flagpole side, Dr. Hume was in the dean's office, the first office on the left. In the same office, Dr. Christopher Longus was present. He was a registrar, standing at a tall, stand-up bookkeeper's desk. I don't exactly know what Dr. Longus was doing. I had no dealing with him at that particular time. And in the first room on your right as you entered was a financial officer. And there was Maury Faulkner, Bill Faulkner's father. Faulkner lived in the old Delta Psi house, which was on the site of the present alumni building. It was called by students St. Anthony's Hall, although fraternities were not running at that time. It was an imposing red brick building, built pretty much on the style of that building just across the road from the Confederate Monument, which now houses art, but formerly housed geology, and which in my day was the law building, and was originally the university's library about 1890. I paid Maury Faulkner $80. That included all my fees, room rent for a semester, laundry for a month, and board up to November 1. And that was exactly what I had, a check for $80. I also had $20 in cash to buy books and other incidentals until November 1. Books were bought in what we call the post office building, roughly on the site of the present Fraser Hall. In the basement was a barbershop operated by a student. Haircuts cost 35 cents. The upper left-hand part of the building was the post office. That's where Bill Faulkner was postmaster for a while. The upper right-hand part of the building was Fazin's Coors store. They had a soda fountain. They sold paper, ink, and other sundries, and books. Jeff Hamm was working in the bookstore at the time, and also for the Alumni Association, I'd rather think. He must have been just recently married. I remember frequently seeing Ms. Hume walking down the sidewalk with him. Slim, erect, black hair, very pretty young woman. Now, these costs in money may seem almost unbelievable to you. They do to me now. However, I kept a little account book during those years, and my daughter-in-law ran across it not too many years ago and almost went into hysterics when she saw my total for that first year, $340. To her question, how did you do it? I had the obvious answer. It wasn't too difficult. That's about what I had. And don't feel sorry for me, I added. I don't remember suffering too much. I enjoyed that first year. So there I was on Thursday morning, having paid the university a total of $80 in fees and having spent $15.90 for paper, ink, and for books, fully paid up and ready for the University of Mississippi to do its worst for me. Out of six teachers that fall, I had three first-class ones, one who was mediocre, and two who were strictly losers. Not a bad batting average. In European history, I had Professor W.C. Murphy, called Pat Murphy by the students. He was a round-faced fellow with balding, sandy hair, little round, china-blue eyes. A very interesting and competent lecturer. Very excellent man. He was faculty advisor for Hermian Literary Society and very popular with the students. Faculty, however, were very cool towards him, and we couldn't understand why. He lived in a brick house across the bridge where the home economics house now is. The faculty may have known something that we students didn't know, because after I left, I understand, he was caught involved in what Benjamin Franklin would have referred to as an indiscreet affair with a young lady. And Dr. Hume, being chancellor and being Dr. Hume, Pat left us suddenly and completely. In organic chemistry, I had Dr. John Nesbitt Swan, a Hopkins graduate. He was hipped on pure water and pure foods and an ardent opponent of smoking. But he was a first-class teacher, and when he had finished with us, I was confident that I knew organic chemistry as it was taught in those days and in the textbook I was studying. In French, Taylor McElroy and I had Professor Augeron. He was tall, almost swarthy, with a little black mustache and coal black hair that he wore always slicked down. He was a graduate of French and Belgian colleges with an impressive record in the areas of geology and archaeology, although he insisted time and again, waving his finger at us, that he was not a language teacher. Taylor McElroy sat next to me, and he used to punch me and say, well, he acts like one. Augeron also insisted that he was an anthropologist, but more of that later. He was a demanding and an excellent teacher. Altogether, he was what our French friends would call formidable. To this day, every time Taylor McElroy meets me on the street, he addresses me as Monsieur Louis, imitating Professor Augeron, and I always come back with him, Monsieur McElroy, because that's what Augeron taught him. There's a story about Augeron that was told me by Dr. Kennan. Augeron, as I said, had a very impressive research area in the area of the fossil remains of the tertiary era. He had worked for the Mexican government, perhaps in their big museum in Mexico City, until he became a refugee as a result of the Huerta Revolution. Now, he was anxious to establish himself in his proper field. He was just teaching French, really, because Dr. Brown, out of sympathy for him, had gotten him a job temporarily. So he was anxious to establish himself in his proper field and in an American university. And he thought that an American degree of some kind, a master's degree, would be of help to him. He therefore appealed to our graduate committee. The graduate school had not yet been established. And it was finally agreed that Augeron would clean up, label, and re-identify a collection of minerals and fossils that had been kicked around the university for years and much abused, and to stand an oral examination. So, on the appointed day, Dr. Kennan says, he met with a committee, which consisted of Alexander Lee Bondurant, Calvin S. Brown, and William Lee Kennan. Now, Bondy was a Latin scholar. Dr. Brown had two doctoral degrees, but one of them was in English, and I'm sure the other one wasn't in archaeology or paleontology. And Dr. Kennan was a physical chemist by training, teaching physics. So they debated anxiously among themselves without coming to any conclusion, as to what questions they could ask this formidable candidate that would be appropriate without being embarrassing to themselves. The final conclusion on the part of Bondi, who was the senior member of the group, was, "Kennan, you are the junior member of this committee. You lead off." So they met with Professor Ogeron. He met them in his parlor, dressed in gray striped pants, a starched shirt with a stand-up collar, and a gray morning coat. He was standing by a table literally piled with copies of his reprints and monographs. At Bondi's request, then, Dr. Kennan led off. He, too, had given much thought as to what he could possibly ask. And finally, he says, "Professor Ogeron, could you tell us just why you chose the tertiary era as your area of specialization?" He says Professor Ogeron stuck his hand in his coat front as though he were addressing the French Academy and replied or declaimed more or less as follows. "I was born and reared in the valley of the Loire, than which there is no more perfect exposure of the entire sequence of tertiary formations in the whole world. Before I had graduated from the lycée, I had collected and identified umpteen fossil specimens from these tertiary formations. X numbers of these specimens had never been known before, and I had the honor of being allowed to name Y numbers of them myself. The results of these researches will be found organized and printed in these reprints and monographs which I have on the table before me." So he finished and looked at Dr. Kennan, and Dr. Kennan looked at him, and then turning, he says, "I am quite satisfied, Dr. Brown. I now turn the candidate over to you." Ogeron left us and went to the University of Texas as an anthropologist and spent the rest of his career there. In English, I had hoped to get Professor Irvin, called Puss Irvin by the students because he spoke with a soft and purring tone of voice. Students found him pleasant, and they liked to study under him, for he believed you learn to write by writing and writing and writing. But instead, I drew Harry Brown, a son-in-law of Dr. Alfred Hume. Harry's wife had died in one of the flu epidemics of 1917-18. He was a lawyer, just out of the army, trying to get his feet on the ground again and trying to pull himself together after his loss. His law training made him seem a little pompous to us, but he labored mightily and faithfully, and it isn't his fault that he didn't strike a spark in me. We did pull one student trick on him. About the middle of the spring semester, we observed that he was getting behind on grading his themes later and later. And so we all got together and agreed that we would all write the longest themes we could possibly put together and really swamp him out. And I believe we must have done it. I think the last two or three themes we wrote for him never did get graded. The only thing I really remember about that class is completely irrelevant. The meaning of the expression, "tinker to evers to chance." I doubt if anyone living would recognize it. But when I was about 8 or 9, we lived in Columbia, Mississippi, where there was a Bush League semi-pro basketball team, the Red Devils. The playing field was only 2 or 3 blocks from our house, so we kids used to wander over and watch from the fence line or maybe from under the grandstand. And we picked up a lot of baseball slang without always understanding exactly what it meant. Some phrases we were wary enough not to carry home, But one stuck in our minds as being something that indicated a thing being very felicitous, good things all around. It was Tinker to Evers to Chance. Now in this freshman English textbook we had, there was an example of a well-written newspaper account of a baseball inning between a Chicago team, the White Sox, is that Chicago, and someone else. And there was my expression. These were the names of the White Sox shortstop, second baseman, and first baseman. These men were exceptionally skillful in an exceptionally skillful game. They were so skillfully and completely coordinated that the expression became absolutely synonymous with that beautiful and ballet-like action, which is a perfectly executed double play. Tinker to Evers to Chance, short to second to first. There it was in my book. So much for the long-term effect of freshman English on me. We also had a course in hygiene. It was taught by a broken-down sort of public health doctor and was a total loss to all of us. He made us buy a thick textbook, Rosenau's Public Health and Hygiene, which cost me $5.60. That was a huge sum in those days. He referred to that book only once and to one chapter, and what he got out of it could have been put on the blackboard with a piece of chalk. It was a long time before I managed to forgive him for making me spend $5.60 for that textbook. That leaves Professor Robert Torrey, my freshman mathematics teacher. I made A's in his course, all right. I'd been well grounded by Miss Pearl Spann in Jackson, but Grandma Torrey taught me very little. He was the hardest-headed, most inflexible teacher I ever had. I don't think he'd ever had any mathematics beyond algebra and trig, and that he knew by rote. In later years, when I knew him as a friend, and I did become his good friend after I returned to Oxford, he confided to me that he had not pursued his graduate studies at the University of Chicago because he couldn't handle that calculus. If someone asked him why the original equation on the blackboard, after having been subjected to several manipulations, looked different from the initial statement of it, he would explain it thus. Sticking his walking stick up from behind the desk, he would ask, "What's this?" "The end of your walking stick." "But it's still my walking stick." "Yes, sir." Then reversing the stick, he would show the top end of it above the desk with the same routine. "What's this?" "Your walking stick." "It's the same stick." "Yes, sir." "Well, it's just like that with that equation on the blackboard. It's the same equation both times." To the frequent question which always comes up in a mathematics class, why? His invariable answer was, "Why did the old cow cross the road?" I've heard many ribald answers suggested to that question out of class, but none of them that would be suitable for repetition here. It reminds me of the English poet Auden's description of the mathematics he learned in his English public school. Minus times minus equals plus. The reason for this, we need not discuss. Right after second semester registration, two of my friends, H.B. Lingle and Leonard Lockett, came up with a suggestion that we all of us, Lingle, Lockett, Lewis, and Lockett, register for a first semester freshman Greek class that was being organized by Dr. Milton at 2 p.m. Monday, Wednesday, Friday. They thought it would be fun to see if you could actually learn to read stuff that was written in that funny alphabet. I was already finding it my 15-hour load wasn't very burdensome. That bloomin' hygiene didn't count as part of a decent load. And I had read the catalog carefully enough to observe that if I was careful about my scheduling, I could qualify either for a B.S. or a B.A. degree and still take all the science and mathematics in sight. So I decided to go for a B.A. degree to please my father. My father never complained about my registering for a B.S. degree at all. But I was quite sure that he was disappointed that I wasn't taking a B.A. degree. He was educated in an era in which the B.S. degree was the degree of an educated man who, in taking the degree, had studied Greek and Latin. He himself had not only studied Greek and Latin, but also Hebrew in theological school. And so I decided, you see, I was beginning to grow up a little bit. I decided that if Father was paying for my education, I might as well get for him what he wanted, if at the same time I could get my mathematics and science. So I decided to go for a B.A. degree, which required Greek, and I signed up with the class. There were only about 12 of us, and it was one of the happiest choices I ever made. I got to know well Dr. Alfred Milden, Canadian by birth, a graduate of the University of Toronto and of the Johns Hopkins University. He must have been in his 50s then. He was a square-built gentleman, white-haired, and we thought him old. He had the pleasantest classroom manner you ever saw. I don't think I ever saw him frown, except occasionally when we were reading aloud a line of Greek poetry and ran out of breath. He would frown in mock distress and exclaim, "Oh, Mr. Lingle, Mr. Lingle, you're putting a hiatus in the middle of that beautiful line of Greek's hexameter." Dr. Milden was a true scholar. I think he knew everything about Greek that there was to be known. He knew every trick in the pedagogical trade, and he used them with the most obtrusive and consummate skill. He lived the life of a guileless man who always seemed to expect the best out of everyone and never anticipated the worst. And I, at least, responded to his efforts. His classes to me, I took 10 hours of that freshman Greek and 6 hours of Xenophon and Herodotus, and every hour of it was a pure joy. That he was not as naive as he seemed is shown by an incident that happened after I returned to Ole Miss to teach. I had occasion to go to his office one afternoon to ask him some kind of question and found him discussing a recent test with two students. They had missed his test, and they'd come try to persuade him to give them a makeup. And Dr. Milden obviously had no intention of giving a makeup test to them. He was volubly suggesting that they take the test questions which he was giving them and go home and work the answers out with the aid of that textbook. It would do them ever so much more good, he was explaining to them. That would be a true learning experience and not just a testing trial. And when they finally gave in and left, he turned to me with a gentle smile and said, "Now that first young gentleman missed the test because he was called home on account of the sudden death of his mother. And in his distressed frame of mind, I would think of making him make up that makeup test. Besides, he's a very good student. He probably will go home and work it up as I asked him to. Now, that other young gentleman says he missed the test because he went to his midday lunch early and then went to his room to take a nap so he would be completely rested for my 2 o'clock class. And he slept through the test and didn't wake up till 3:30. But he's a very indifferent student, and I didn't think it was politic to ask him what he was doing the night before that made him so sleepy at midday the next day. Do you? Now, just before he died in 1944, Dr. Milton had bought a beautiful pocket-sized Greek New Testament.